1935, the Lions win the NFL championship. The Detroit Tigers take the World Series. The Red Wings bring home Lord Stanley's Cup. Joe Louis begins his rise to world domination. This transforms the Motor City into Detroit, City of Champions.
There's the crack of the bat and the highlight of my week. It is time to record an episode of the podcast, Detroit, City of Champions, aptly named after a trilogy of books written by...
Charles Avison.
I'm Jamie Flanagan, and we're just kind of walking through these stories. Charles, it's just always amazing the information that you're able to... You've dug up over the years and years. Out of these three books, how many years of research do you think you put into all three of those books?
I would have to say, if you add in like the... If you add in like the original
your college work,
yeah, the college work, yeah. I would, you know, it's probably overall probably about 10 years. It's about 10 years,
wow.
Seven for the books, like specifically the three books, and then the 3 years. Like, I mean, it was like 3 months for the thesis, and then like a few days or a week for the original, like little 2-page paper.
Well, and it shows because I mean the pictures that you've dug up and just everything you've put together for this package. Is really cool. If anybody's looking for the books, where do people find the books?
DetroitCityOfChampions.com.
Okay.
Yep. So it's as easy as that. I mean, once you know the title of the book.
Do you have to buy all three, or just can I buy one and ease my way into it?
Yeah, absolutely. You can buy them one at a time. And then there's like, you know, if you buy the full trilogy.
But yeah, when you buy the bundle, you get some extra little bonus stuff.
Yeah, well, when you buy the books, like the full set, it has all three books, and it comes in a case. Like this really, I like to think it's a pretty nice case.
It is. It's very cool.
The way I set it up was that each book has like its own little promotional items, I guess you say. Like, so the first book comes with bookmarks.
Okay.
The second book comes with the movie that we went over, the Play Ball movie.
Yeah.
And then the third one comes with the box itself. So if you buy them individually, by the time you get to the third one, the box actually comes with it. The other two fit into it.
Oh, nice.
And so besides the website, if you're at Partridge Creek Mall in Clinton Township or 12 Oaks Mall in Novi, there's a store called Inspire Marketplace, and you actually find me in those stores quite a bit. So I do a lot of work inside
the stores. It's home away from home.
Yeah, in fact, I did a lot of the work I did for these books in those stores, and I just remember I was so knee deep in the third book because I do a ton of work in these stores because we have like my own little store inside of the larger store.
Yeah,
and so So the third book, when I was like, I was trying to get it out for Christmas in 2014. It was like this, it was just this massive rush to get all the photos done and all this different stuff I had to do. And I actually, there was two nights that I actually, because I was working so much in that mall, I actually slept in the store two nights. I slept in the store in the back room.
Security guards are like, what are you doing?
No, they couldn't see anything.
But it was better.
Because I had to work at the store the next day.
Sure, better than driving home.
It was better.
Wasting time,
like going home, because it was a half hour drive.
Yeah.
You know, going home, working on it, sleeping, and then the half hour drive back the next morning.
Yeah.
And so I would just actually sleep in the store, and then
that is dedication.
Oh yeah! So I'd wake up, and I was saving an hour.
Yeah.
You know, not having to drive. It was an hour. That's how to the grindstone it was in the last sort of moments of the third book.
Oh man! So, but because we trilogy of books, and then we just move on. We haven't really talked about that much.
I like mentioning that because
it's episode 45.
Yeah. So it's we're on episode 45, and you mentioned this is like your favorite day of the week, man. I love it too, Jamie.
It's the greatest
thing for me is that, you know, for most of this time, for the last, you know, I've been doing this now since, you know, this has been my bread and butter. I have a publishing house called Diomedia Publishing, based in Detroit. And, you know, I've been doing this since 2008, you know, 2007, if you want to go to even before the books were done, because writing the first book, I mean, I wasn't working when I was doing it. That's all I was doing was writing and working on this, and you know, surviving off of nothing.
Mm-hmm.
And so for most of that time, whenever I talk about the City of Champions story, it's always starting from the very beginning. Like it's usually in small fragments that I tell the story when I'm either like telling, like it's always introducing the story to somebody. It's always like I get like 2 minutes to, you know, like as a pitch. It's always I'm like basically a pitch man.
Yeah.
And so, and you know, that's how I sell the books, or else I've done library. I do a lot of library talks and, you know, speeches and stuff like that. And those can go like a half hour to an hour.
Sure.
But again, every single time we start out, it's starting from the beginning, and by the time that hour is over, it's just it's. I've had to glance over every single subject. Sometimes something will stand out and people really want to know about some aspect or another. But otherwise, it's just wash, rinse, repeat for 9, 10 years is telling the same story. And so it's an absolute joy to be able to, you know, say episode 45 and spend the kind of time,
eighth episode about Joe Lewis.
That's what I mean.
So I'm excited.
It's just an absolute joy to be able to really dive into these subjects, you know.
You probably forgot some of this crap. You're like, oh yeah, I forgot that.
Well, I do have to look over it because the first few shows, that, you know, it kind of annoyed me because my brain, the way like I've got so many other projects on my plate right now. Now I'm working on, I kind of allude to this baseball analytics thing. I do baseball analytics every single day. I do a lot of stock market stuff. I do a lot of crypto stuff. And I do that stuff, you know, because I'm trying to raise money to do the movie. I'm trying to raise money to do my real goal is to buy my own professional baseball team to do this analytics. And so, you know, introduce something new into the world with this, in essence, Moneyball 2. And so, you know, I spent a lot of time doing all this. And so the first few shows, I'll admit it right here, you know, we had a couple of retractions in the first few shows.
Right.
Because I wasn't I'll be honest right now on the show, I wasn't focused on it. Because my brain is locked into a subject. And this subject, for me, the writing phase of it really did end, you know, in 2014. I mean, and this is a project that, you know, 7 years old as far as... You know, I've been doing is baseball analytics, like every single day for all that time. And so, you know, so that's what I'm saying. So, like, by no means would I ever forget the story. The major parts, of course, are just etched in my brain. But I realized after the first three shows that, you know, this was really my first love, my first entry into this whole, sports history, sports analytics world. And so I just owed, you know, like, it kind of reminded me of when I first got started. I'm like, you know, I would have given anything to do a show like this. And so I was like, I just made myself promise, like, on show day, you know, you're spending the time you need to do to get your notes together and get your facts and figures ready to go so that I can present this give this story, you know, the credit that, you know, the time and the effort that it's due. You know, I'm the corrections and the going back, I said the wrong date for this. That wasn't given this story the attention that I think.
So, and the people that have been joining us and are joining us now, if you're just finding us for the first time or along for the ride, we appreciate you and make a point to pull over, safely pause your car, and then go to wherever fine podcasts are given away, because they're not sold, they're given away, and like and subscribe, follow us, collect, whatever it might be on your platform. Thanks for being with us and following along, and if you leave a comment wherever you've collected us, that helps immensely. So if you could do that right now, we'd appreciate it. And then that leads us to talking to Joe Lewis, and we're in the middle, we're like just like 3-4 months into 35.
1935, yeah. We're still in the early parts of the year of 35 for Joe.
And already just some amazing stuff. His earnings were like, in the first 2 months, were like more than he's made in his lifetime.
In his life, yeah. I mean, it was staggering amounts. Yeah. We're going from the fight. I have the number. You have the numbers in front of you.
Yeah.
But his first fight was at $35.
His
first fight's $35.
Right.
And then it's like $50.
Yeah.
Great. You know, it's a different, you know, value for money back in those days. But you know, this it doesn't change the fact that it's still, you know, like from $30 to $50.
Yeah.
You know, now we're getting into the $4,000 and $6,000. You know, what was the last show we were talking about? He was getting up into $4,300 a fight. His fight against Natty Brown in March of 1935 was $6,500.
Yeah.
I mean, this is his total winnings, $25,000 by March of 1935 is his total winnings. I mean, these are numbers that he may not have ever even thought possible in his life.
Oh yeah.
I mean, like a combined total of his life, he may never even thought he would see that kind of money.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, he's already. I mean, and so, and we talked about, we're not going to go over the first seven parts of the Joe Lewis thing.
Right.
But we talked last episode about the idea that, you know, Joe was really, I mean, I like almost like a child of destiny. Like he found himself in the vortex of all of these powerful forces that is in the forces being like Mike Jacobs, who is this, you know, he's on the outside looking in from the Madison Square Garden. And he's, you know, he's this incredible, we established a lot of his credentials in the last show, but he's like this incredible boxing promoter.
Yeah.
I mean, this incredible sports promoter that's worked himself up from the ground level, where he, you know, he started off in Hell's Kitchen, New York.
Yeah.
He started off in Hell's Kitchen, New York. I mean, the bottom of the, you know, in just at the very bottom, and built himself into a multimillionaire. I mean, yeah. This is a super rich guy, and was like a student of Tex Rickard, and so, you know, who was the original boxing like super legend. Like, he was like sort of the Don King of his era.
Uh-huh.
And so everybody thought that, and Tex Rickard was like only solely responsible for I think it was the fourth incarnation of Madison Square Garden, like when they revamped it and all this. Like, that was Tex Rickard that did all that. And so, and everybody thought that Mike Jacobs was going to take over for Tex Rickard when he died. And so, but that wasn't the case. And it went to Joe Johnson. The last name was Johnson, but... Jimmy Johnson.
Yeah.
And so he went, so that this control of the Madison Square Garden went to Jimmy Johnson, and Mike Jacobs was on the outside looking in. And he's like, in his mind, like, you know, he was basically robbed from what should have been his next stage in life,
yeah.
Which is to run the gardens and run the promotions. And so Mike Jacobs, it finds himself where he's like, well, I'm gonna have the best boxing promoter in the world, you know, regardless if I have the gardens, but I just need myself a super fighter,
right?
And so we also talked about specifically this idea of the milk fund for babies, which mm-hmm, was just mm-hmm. the key thing that the Hearst newspapers were donating, like they were given the Madison Square Gardens free coverage for their events, free
right.
promotions,
yeah.
And in exchange for money coming from the gate going to Millicent Hearst, which is William Randolph Hearst's wife, to her charity, which is called the Milk Fund for Babies. But when the Gardens started losing money in the Depression, and they also had no major boxing draws. I mean, they had heavyweight champions, but there was nothing that was really, you know, super iconic.
Because the last champion retired, and then nobody really stepped into
Gene
the limelight.
Tunney, yeah, Gene Tunney retired.
Yeah,
and so it left the
a
belt.
Void, yeah.
Yeah, a void for the, you know, so the belt usually, you know, a lot of times passes from, you know, to the next victor, and then that person loses, and it goes on,
sure.
and so on and so forth.
But with that retirement, it just kind of fizzled.
Exactly. So they had to just kind of do like a round robin tournament style, in essence, in order to figure out who was the next champ. And then the belt did start to pass around a little bit. But none of the fighters that it passed to were really these, you know, dynamic, you know, like super superstars.
Yeah.
I mean, they were all stars in their own right. They're some of the most well-known names in boxing, you know, in sports history. You have Max Schmeling,
yeah.
was the guy who took over the belt from Gene Tunney in 1930. You have Jack Sharkey takes over from Schmeling in 32. Primo Carnero, who we're going to get to know very well in the next episode, in 1933, takes over the belt. And then 1934, Max Baer beats Carnera. And Max Baer, who is the father of Max Baer Jr. from Beverly Hillbillies,
who
plays Jethro Bodine.
Yeah.
Like, you know, it was such a kick for me to find that out when I was writing the early books, because I was a huge Beverly Hillbillies fan.
Oh,
absolutely
yeah.
massive Beverly Hillbillies fan.
Heck yeah.
Yeah. And so the fact that, you know, Max Baer Jr., I'm like, man, this is great. This is, you know, his dad is mm-hmm. you know, the subject of this story, a major subject. And so, Max Baer was great. You know, these guys are all great fighters.
He was a great villain. He was like,
yeah,
Max
Baer,
one of the villains.
In the quote we read, we were, you know, the start, we
just egging,
off,
the, egging.
Yeah,
the,
he loved to like, he liked to play the heel, you know, like
yeah,
in the wrestling world, they call it the heel.
The heel, there you
which
go.
Is the guy that the fans all like hate. You know, they all like to boo him, and he likes to rile the fans
up. But they kind
of
like it when he wins, too.
Yeah, they don't absolutely despise him, but he just plays the guy that they all love to hate, kind of.
Yeah,
and so that was the character that Baer played in the ring. But from all accounts, he was everybody loved him. I mean, he was a, you know, beloved sports figure of his time. But in any case, there was no true like mega star in boxing, and so that's, you know, and that was another reason why the gate at the Madison Square Garden suffered. And that's why eventually they started cutting back on their donations to the Milk Fund for Babies.
Yeah.
And the writers of the Hearst newspapers saw this as an opportunity, because they're like, Well, you know, we can. So they basically made them free agents because they're not now. They're not beholden to the Garden anymore because they're not cutting out the Hearst. You know, there's no the Hearst charities that are not getting any money. So they're not. They're under no obligation to feed the Garden any free promotion anymore.
Right.
So instead of giving the Garden free promotion, this is a chance for them to, you know, rewrite the deal, so to speak. And so that's when they connected with Mike Jacobs. And so now the idea is that Mike Jacobs has got this publicity machine. He just needs the right person to direct this machine towards.
And he finds Joe.
And that's when he starts to hear about Joe. And so we talked about how Jacobs, they had this meeting where all these New York writers came to Detroit.
Right.
They came to watch Joe, you know, they came to watch Joe fight Natty Brown at Olympia at Olympia Stadium. And Joe didn't put up his best fight ever, but it was enough for them for Mike Jacobs to sort of, you know, show his wares to these writers and give these guys an idea of who they would be writing about. And so there's this huge, we talked again about this meeting at it was called the Frog Club in Paradise Valley in Black Bottom, Detroit, where this deal was signed. And the idea for Mike Jacobs at this, you know, the idea that they presented was that Joe, you know, under contract now with Mike Jacobs and that. And of course, Joe retained his management group. And so the idea was that the machine needed time to rev up the engine.
Right.
Okay. Like now, so Joe was going to, in essence, Joe was going to travel out to do like a little Western series of fights out west.
Uh-huh.
And in the meantime, these New York writers are going to just ramp up this coverage and say, there's this invincible warrior coming from the West, and he's headed to New York. And when he gets here, he's just going to change the world. This is going to be the greatest thing you've ever seen in your life.
Yeah.
And so that was the idea. So he's just going to be pounding these guys. He's, you know, sort of a little mini bum of the month club for Joe. And so in the meantime, so that was the idea. And so he was. So Joe signs up a deal to fight Carnera in June. And so they like in the meantime, like as they're putting all this together, they knew that, you know, they needed a big fight to promote, to get, you know, for Joe's first rung in the ladder. So Carnera, as we mentioned, was the champion in 1933, the heavyweight champ. And so he's a former heavyweight champion. So it's a great, you know, Joe's real first big name fight.
Yeah, okay.
All these other guys have been fighting. There were names. There was guys that were, you know, ranked boxers and that, but nobody that was a former heavyweight champion like Carnera. So this fight was signed by Mike Jacobs with Carnera's managers for a fight in June of 1935. And so in the meantime, like right around the same time, Joe buys his mom a house. He's got this money and as Richard Back's book, he says it's the address for the house at 2100 McDougal,
and it was
a four bedroom brick bungalow, which cost Joe $11,500 for the house. And Joe also made down payments on houses for his sisters, Susie and Emeril, and his brother Pat Brooks Jr. So he made down payments for all of his family. You know, got houses and, you know, set them up because he knew that some big money is about to come in.
He's
already made money, of course, but. You know, now he's got a chance to sort of take care of his family, get them put up in a nice spot, and then now he can continue with his you know, to unroll this plan. So in April 12th of 1935, Joe wins his 18th consecutive fight against a guy named Roy Lazor.
Whoa.
And this is a knockout in the third round in Chicago. In this fight, Joe basically pays for his mom's house because he gets $11,212 off of this fight.
Wow.
Which dwarfs anything he's ever gotten before.
Oh, yeah, it's almost double what he earned in the last
fight, which
was a massive number.
Yeah, so this is a massive fight.
And when was this?
So this was April 12th, 1935.
Okay.
And so now Joe is 18-0.
Wow.
So the next fight after that is April 22nd, 1935, just 10 days later, and Joe's knocks out Biff Bennett. And I was like, there's a couple pictures we've shown. We might have a picture to put up on the screen there of Biff.
Yeah.
It might have even been from a couple weeks ago.
Right.
I was kind of joking with some of my friends about like some of the picture, because there's a really ugly looking knockout picture of Biff Bennett, and he's like, don't get Biff, because he's like legs. It's definitely my book. I think we have it up picture.
Yeah, no, I don't think so.
But it might have been from two shows ago.
Oh, just the knockouts?
Yeah, there's one where Biff's legs are folded under his, like he's like laying on his back, but his legs are underneath his.
Yeah, there it is.
Rear
is
end.
Is that it?
Yeah, like.
Oh, that TV's lagging behind. Yeah.
We were joking. I would show my friends this picture and say, man, we're like, don't get Biffed, you know?
Yeah.
Like, because he's. like unconscious and just looking horrendous. So Joe knocks out Biff Bennett in the first round. Fight lasts a minute and 15 seconds.
Wow.
And so that fight, yeah. So the first fight is in Chicago Stadium, Illinois. The second fight against Biff Bennett, it's in Memorial Hall in Dayton, Ohio. And so he's sort of making his way out west. In this fight, it's a much less amount. Joe, the really after that first one against Roy Lazor, the second fight, this next one against Biff. So this tour isn't necessarily about Joe making these big gates.
Right, right.
It's about just knocking people out and
creating
the ability for these writers to go, man, this next fight only he knocked out Biff Bennett in 1 minute and 15 seconds. How great he is. You know, so he wanted, basically, they're looking for some victims.
Right.
They're looking for some victims here.
Oh,
so now Joe is 19-0, and he gets paid. This one's only $750.
Okay.
This fight's only $750, so it's not a major, you know, massive amount. But
20, who put that in there?
So the next fight is, and again, just 2 weeks after that. So this next one is April 25th, 1935, against a guy named Roscoe Tolles. And this is a TKO in the second round. This is a TKO. I don't have the round knockout, but here's the thing: is in the second round, Roscoe Tolles' side threw in the towel because he was taking such a beating from Joe off the bat.
Yeah.
So the towel they threw in, and the referee kicked the towel out of the ring. He wouldn't let the fight end.
Yeah.
And so Joe
suck it up, Buttercup.
Suck it up. We want at least one more round of a beating, you know? And so I think he went one more. I don't have it written down here, but it was like I think it was only one more round, and then Tolles was counted out. Like the referee did stop the fight because he's like, this now it's getting really ugly. And so it's just crazy that in the second round, Roscoe Tolles' trainers threw the towel in.
Oh my God.
And then the referee kicked it out. He wouldn't let him throw the towel in.
That's too funny.
So that one was in Flint, Michigan.
Right.
And so that fight was in Flint, Michigan. $1,250 Joe got for that fight. But here's the thing. This fight and the next two fights, these don't appear in Joe's fight record. So you actually have to do a little bit of research to dive in to actually read about these. That's why I didn't have the round count out for Roscoe Tolles because it doesn't appear in Joe's record. Like when you look at Joe's total fights, these next three fights are not listed in his record. So Joe stays 19-0 despite the fact that this is his 20th straight victory. So he doesn't even get credit for this on his official record. So his 21st total fight. Is against Willie Davis. It's a rematch of his second fight, or it's a rematch of this is the second time he's faced Willie Davis, and then the previous time was Joe's second ever fight. It was the second fight of Joe's career. We talked about him, which was a TKO in the third round. And this doesn't go much better for Willie Davis.
Yep.
It is a TKO in the second round.
Okay,
and this is in Peoria, Illinois, and it's another $750.
But more great press.
Yeah, but again, the entire time the typewriters are humming in all the Hearst newspapers across the country talking about this incredible fighter, and then the final sort of hype fight. That's why we call this the hype train, because Joe's just on a train headed all over the country knocking people out while the newspapers are hyping people, which is Joe's 22nd actual fight, Joe's still 19-0 regardless. His 22nd fight is against a guy named Gene Stanton, which is a knockout in the third round. And this fight in here has always caught my eye because this one was in Kalamazoo, Michigan.
Oh, okay.
So I'm from Kalamazoo. Okay. I'm not sure if you were I live in Detroit now, but I grew up in Kalamazoo, went to Kalamazoo Hackett High School. And, all my friends are from, I have a lot of friends from Kalamazoo, and one or two might be listening now. So, Kalamazoo, it's just such a great town. I love Kalamazoo. I go back there as much as I can. And so it's always cool that Joe Louis's final fight on this hype tour was in of all the towns, of all the cities in the world.
All the sandwich joints
and
all the
of
world.
All the places in the world he could wrap up this hype tour. It was in Kalamazoo, Michigan. I wish I had the venue, but I don't have that.
Kalamazoo,
another exhibition fight, there's not too much information on it, at least not that I've found. So this one was in Kalamazoo. And $750, another $750 for Joe.
Mm-hmm.
And so now, and this was on May 7th, 1935. So now, over the course of this month and a half, mm-hmm. a little under a month and a half, You know, these, again, these typewriters out there are just humming, right?
Right.
And along the way, they're taking photos. We've got, I know we have a slide. I'll put this slide together.
Yeah.
There's a, where it's a slide of, there's, you know, there's more than just, they're not just hyping up the fact that Joe is this incredible, you know, fighter. They're hyping up the fact that Joe is also this all-American good guy.
Right, right.
So as opposed to
baseball,
because the issue that we began this entire Joe Louis story with was this idea of Jack Johnson and the idea that he had like scandalized, you know, but you know he was a very divisive and very controversial figure in his day, and it led to this idea that no black man's ever going to get a chance to do what Jack Johnson did.
Yeah.
You know, and so along the way, they have to. They're trying to. You know, they didn't really need to do much work with Joe because he was already this nice, humble, God fearing guy who loves his mom. He already was those things.
Yeah.
And there so, but that, but it, but they wanted to bring that issue out. They wanted to really dramatize that issue to make that so that they're saying like this is the anti Jack Johnson.
Not only is he steamrolling people in the ring, he's a heck of a nice guy out of it.
Exactly. Okay. They had to make him palatable to the wider, you know, sports world.
Curtis said hi. Awesome stuff.
That's
Charles.
My brother. Hey, Curtis, how you doing, man?
Hey.
So they've got to present. So it's not just the mauler inside the ring. Joe's also got to be this. You know, he's got to be like Jack Johnson inside the ring, but totally the opposite of Jack Johnson outside the ring. And that's one of the other things. So the photos that we have in that slide to show,
it's up. That's a little lagging.
Good. Yeah. So the photos we have in the slide, it shows Joe like playing baseball, and cooking chicken with his mom, hanging out. You know, like there's a bunch more photos. I have a bunch of photos in the book to show, and those are actually from 1935.
Okay.
So those photos, and there's another one where Joe's doing a.
That's young Joe. That's pretty young Joe.
You can always tell the difference in the Joe Louis shots because the young Joe, he's like, he's got, you know, he's just smaller. It seems like he's leaner, way, you know, just really like, it seemed like he really got bigger. Just his body, you know, it's almost like his head got a little bigger too, like physically.
Yeah.
You can always kind of tell like young Joe versus old Joe.
Mm-hmm.
Young Joe, he is just like he is just like, you know, you can always just tell. Obviously he looks younger, you know. But you can always just kind of see it in these photos.
Yeah.
And the ones I have are from actually 35, like during this whole hyped session where they're trying to get him, you know, they're trying to present him to the public as this, like I say, all-American good guy. So now comes the time for Joe to arrive in New York, to get to New York. And this is just one of the greatest, in the movie, this is like a signature scene.
The
in this
steam
movie.
Coming off the train.
Yeah, yeah. So I have a scene on the, you know, in the screenplay with Joe's arriving in New York, and he's heading out to New York. And so Joe's, you know, he wastes no time. I mean, this last fight against Gene Stanton in Kalamazoo is on May 7th. And in the middle of May, I don't have the exact date, but in the middle of May, Joe arrives in New York. On this train, and I have a photo of what happens when Joe gets there.
Right. Oh my gosh, they're carrying
him. So Joe doesn't even get off the train.
Are those the porters carrying
him? The porters on the train carry Joe off the train like a king.
And they all look like they're having a riot.
They're all loving it. Joe arrives in New York, there is this massive crowd at the train station to greet him. And and there's just this mania. There's like this Joe Louis mania. This is where this Joe Louis mania, it starts right here.
Mm.
So there is no more, people don't know who Joe Louis is anymore.
Right.
From this moment on, Joe Louis is this, the sensation, the mania of Joe Louis is going to grow and grow and grow. Every single day, every single week. Every single month, all the way through 1935, especially in 1935, it is very difficult. I mean, there is very few athletes who have had this type of a mania that's surrounding them. And when you see the newspapers, when you're actually going, like I went through these newspapers every single day, and you can see it, like from the day that Joe arrives in New York, it is Joe Louis every single day. There is article after article in every single paper. It is just, it is
non-stop. So is this in the Detroit paper and
every
the New York
paper
papers?
In the country.
Oh, wow. Okay.
It's across the country.
Wow.
It's every single paper.
All right.
That's what I'm saying. Like Joe Louis mania, like there's like the Hulkamania from the 80s. That was like sort of my first experience with a mania.
The mania. Okay.
You know? Then there's the other sports elements like there was the Fernando mania, Fernando Valenzuela when he first came over.
Sure.
There's this baseball mania where like, you know, in Detroit we have like Mark the Bird Fidrich, that kind of a, where he single player just captures people's imagination, and that's all anybody talks about. Like, every time that player pitches, the crowds are just packed. Doesn't even matter how good the team is doing. There's a mania about that player. Like, Babe Ruth had at least one year where there was a mania. Probably most of Babe Ruth's career was a mania.
Yeah.
But there was a couple years that were more concentrated on that than others. But there's a lot of different cases where there's just like this huge, a mania that grips the public, and there's just nobody else on the world that they want to hear about or talk about except for Joe, except for that athlete. And that's what Joe was in.
Okay.
And so that's what's so incredible is that here's this guy, to hash back all the way, Buckaloo Mountains of Alabama, in the shadow of the Buckaloo Mountains of Alabama.
Yeah, yeah,
he just
yeah,
had nothing yeah. and grew up in this, had the most unlikeliest of heroes. And here he is, and he's just, again, there's this mania that surrounds him. And I think for good reason, because a lot of people, there's this American dream that people can rise from obscurity and become this hero to millions, to achieve incredible things. That's like one of the most like American things that there is this dream, like Abraham Lincoln, like log cabin of the White House, a million other examples. But yeah. But when a hero does come out from
the cherry tree,
but when somebody comes out from the lower ranks, so to speak, and rises to the top to the pinnacle of that, of the world like that. I think that's really the genesis of that mania.
Yeah.
They don't go crazy for somebody that started out with all the things that were, all the, attributes born to, money and their silver spoon in their hand and all, and then they did other things. There's usually a mania when it's somebody that people can identify with. Talking about Fernando Valenzuela, that's a perfect example. He came from this nobody ever heard of this town that he came from in Mexico, and then like 2 years later he's pitching for the Dodgers and just like winning every single game. It's like people, I think, really when they that's one of the primary ingredients of these manias is when you have somebody that you can identify with, somebody that comes from from nowhere and then just rise up. So
well, and in 35, we're in the throes of the Depression.
Absolutely.
So I mean, a lot of people are identifying with a rough beginning.
Absolutely. So, it's a guy that came out of nowhere.
Yep.
And another thing to not discount is that Joe Louis, since Jack Johnson, Jack Johnson again was an incredibly polarizing figure. I read several quotes that were black leaders of the time. Mm-hmm. Some of these major black leaders at the time that were saying Jack Johnson did tremendous damage for us, for our community. That was out of their own mouths. And so now Joe is he's coming into the situation where he is basically, he's becoming universally beloved.
Mm-hmm.
So there's no polarization with Joe. There's no controversy. He's just, and that's to say, Joe is emerging as the first universally beloved African-American superstar.
Yeah.
And the first, and this is the guy, people talk about Jackie Robinson. Jackie, as we're going to see, one of the things we're going to talk to him about the legacy of Joe. There would have been this is Jackie Robinson before Jackie Robinson.
Mm-hmm.
This Joe set the stage for everything that came after him.
Yeah.
Jesse Owens in the 1936 Olympics. They're going to be we're going to be showing here in another couple episodes how Jesse Owens might not have even gotten a shot at the 1936 Olympics, except for what they were doing was pairing him with Joe.
Oh, wow.
They were putting him in the same room with Joe. They were staging photos with Joe Louis and Jesse Owens and saying, look, Jesse Owens is friends with Joe Louis. And because of that, that's what imparted some of Joe onto Jesse Owens.
Give the fella a chance to run.
Exactly. Right. He can do it on the track and field, what Joe's doing in the boxing ring.
Yeah.
And that's what helped propel Jesse Owens to the opportunity
to
even be in the 1936 Olympics. And the same thing for Jackie Robinson himself, who is Jackie Robinson, a lot of, and for good reason, Jackie Robinson is the man who broke the color barrier in baseball and this and all the obstacles he had overcome, of course. But Jackie Robinson himself said that he would have never have gotten that chance in baseball if Joe had not done his thing in boxing. And, of course, it all begins in 1935.
Right, right. There is so, May 35 being carried off the train.
Yeah, so Joe, and that's what's so cool is this is that moment where this mania begins.
I love encapsulated.
And that's what I'm saying.
Picture.
That photo is so great because it's at that moment that all these other things in the world of American sport, you know, like these other, you know, Jesse Owens and Jackie Robinson and then everything else, the floodgates being opened thereafter. It all begins right there with that moment that Joe was carried off the train. That's why that photo to me is just so iconic and so important. Because that's that moment, you see. The 1935 story with Joe Louis getting a lot of times just gets overlooked and like, oh, 35, he did all these things, and then then let's move on to the next stuff. Let's move on to the Schmeling fight and all this other stuff.
If anybody's listening to the podcast, it is on YouTube and Facebook video versions of it that have these pictures. And of course, you could always, like as we mentioned at the top of the show, you can pick up the book.
I'm not schlepping
the book. I've mentioned the book twice in this episode. I don't think I've schlepped the book since.
Well, the crazy thing is you're the one that
Champions
keep,
Day.
Yeah, you're like yeah. I
you just get in here. You want to talk about the story?
I don't even.
I'm the one that stops you.
Yeah, you're the one stopping me, going, "Hey, man, pitch your book. We got a show. We're doing a show here. Like, should tell people that they can buy a book from." Like, oh yeah, that's right.
Well,
I guess they can.
I forgot, like I said, we're just hanging out.
I got stuff to sell. You know?
I enjoy doing this.
Me too. I just love doing it, dude.
So I love how important this picture is.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. Once you see understand that concept. That is at this moment that Joe, like, you know, and in the screenplay, I wrote a segment in there about Joe riding the train to New York and having no idea what to expect.
Right.
You know, where it's kind of calm in the train and it's kind of ho-hum. And then in the screenplay, the way that it's like when Joe pulls into the station, he looks out the window and sees this throng of people, you know, like that's how I wrote it in the screenplay. You know, he's coming into the station going,
God, you gotta wonder what's going through his mind, you know?
Yeah,
because he's fought in front of big crowds, but to have him on the platform waiting for
that's what I'm trying to say. That's how
it's like the Beatles arriving, you know,
exactly. That's that mania, like a Beatles mania. That's what they called that.
Yeah.
When the Beatles showed up, there's like people are screaming their heads off just for you to look at the Beatles. You know, there's like I was watching the Netflix show The Crown the other day, and it's like, you know, Princess Diana had a mania when she went through Australia, there was like this huge mania. For it. That's what I mean. Like, you know, that you know, when the astronauts, when they landed on the moon, they, you know, they went to this world tour, and everywhere they went, there was a mania, you know. That's like, and so that's what I'm saying. Like, Joe, that's why I wrote it in the screenplay. Is Joe's pulling up to the station.
You got to wonder
he's looking
he
out the
thinking.
Window. Yeah, that's what I mean. I wrote that into the screenplay. Like, what was I spent a lot of time on this particular scene because it was, you know, it was really Joe's transition from. You know, his world where he's just making money as an up-and-coming fighter. And then there's this, like, the second that he arrives in New York, everything changes.
Mm-hmm,
he is no longer this, like, sort of up-and-coming guy, and he's trying to make money for his family.
This is the turning point.
Joe now is you know, at first he's going to be a national, you know, he's a major top figure in the world, you know, not just a sports world, but he is a major figure in just the national scene. I mean,
what fights do we have lined up? Why? What?
Nothing.
What is he here in
New
York
for?
He's here to train. He's just here to train in New York.
He's here, really to drum up extra interest in this fight against Primo Carnera.
Okay, where's that going to take place?
So that's going to be at Yankee Stadium.
Okay.
Yes.
All right. So that's in New York.
So it's in New York. So he doesn't have the Madison Square Garden. So we're going to have it at Yankee Stadium.
Okay.
See, so it's going to be a different venue.
All right.
And so Joe. So he arrives, he gets carried off the train in the signature moment. And then the next stop is over at there's a big press conference where Mike Jacobs does most of the talking at this press conference.
Sure.
Joe's kind of quiet. They ask him a couple of basic questions. And then they sort of have like they take the Joe on this little tour through these like entertainment district. Like they take him to the Harlem Opera House. Where he does a boxing skit with a guy named Dusty Fletcher.
It's like he's as if Saturday Night Live existed, he would have been on Saturday Night Live.
That's exactly the case. Yeah, exactly. And he does this skit with a guy named Dusty Fletcher.
Yeah.
This boxing skit, and he's doing four shows a day for a week. So they're using this as like drumming up interest and drumming up this excitement for Joe. And then, so he's, you know, he's, so the apartment building he's staying in, He's staying at this apartment while he's in New York, and Duke Ellington moves into that apartment building just so he can like be in the same building as Joe.
Yeah, so that's fantastic.
Meets Duke Ellington, a jazz musician.
I want to meet Duke Ellington.
Exactly. So that's what I'm saying. Like, Joe was attracting these major stars, you know, to come out there to just that want to just be near. You know, imagine Joe. You know, Joe was reading about Duke Ellington for his, you know, last couple of years, and he's now Duke Ellington. Hey, man, I just want to meet you. You know,
you're like, oh my God.
Exactly. So that's what I'm saying. It's just such an incredible time, you know, and that's why I wanted to really put that in the screenplay. And that's what's so important about this year is to focus on this transition of Joe from this up and coming guy into this, you know, it's a now it's a whole different world for this guy going forward.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, he's just paraded through these high end bars. Another one of these guys he meets is a guy named Bill Bojangles Robinson, who is going to end up doing, you know, like there's, I've got photos of him. Joe, he's a dancer, and Joe, I've got pictures of Joe doing these like dances with him a little bit. You know, I got some pictures of him. And so, yeah, so Joe, you know, that's the excitement phase.
Yeah.
And then so things kind of settle down after about, you know, after like a week or so. Settling down is meaning like Joe actually gets to start working on his training.
Okay.
This is like because his fight with Primo Carnera is coming up for June 25th. That's the scheduled date of the fight.
Okay.
And so he settles into this camp, and it's called Pompton Lakes.
All right.
It's in New Jersey. And the idea is that you would have this camp where Joe's going to train every day, right? He's going to do his workouts, his road work, his, you know, he's going to box all these like sparring partners. And so the sparring partners they got to bring in are these like they're looking for people that are super tall because we're going to show Primo Carnera. I think it was like 6'6", 290-something pounds.
Wow.
He's just a monster of a man. And so the sparring partners he's got to have are guys that are super tall.
Sure.
So he's, you know, so he's kind of work get, you know, really practice for training to fight against a guy who's going to be taller than him.
Yeah.
And so anyways, but what's interesting is that what happens that, you know, the Pompton Lakes itself serves as a hype, as, you know, as like a sort of a hype thing for, mm-hmm. you know, there's reporters there every day. There's all this stuff going on. And it's like this little village that that evolves around just this. You know, there's a boxing ring Joe trains, and then what ends up evolving out of. And I've got a great picture, but I wanted to save it for one of the last episodes because when he's training for Max Baer.
Okay.
But I've actually got a photo. It's in the books, of course. But it's an aerial photo of what the ring that Joe Louis was training in,
mm-hmm.
what it looked like around it. All right, and it's like, I guess that's a teaser for a couple episodes from now when we show this photo.
Yeah.
But it's just like, it looks like the actual fight itself. I mean, there's thousands.
And that's just media and fans.
And fans around this ring, and just watching Joe spar and practice. And it really showed, because I wanted to save it for that episode, because by that point, the mania has gotten so huge. Yeah. I wanted to show, because I don't want to say, oh, this is from the Max Baer fight when we're talking about the Primo Carnera fight. So that's why I do have photos from the Primo fight, which shows, you know, it shows Joe training with some photos of people around it. But more specifically, what I have, especially since this is a podcast, is I have a quote that I'm going to read.
Yes.
That is this is Bob Murphy walking through of this Pompton Lakes
scene.
Camp
okay.
and explaining what he's seeing
right.
and how he first walks up and what he sees. So this is a tour through Pompton Lakes, and as Joe is getting ready for Primo Carnera. And it's just an absolutely, like, this is one of the quotes where the title of the quote is actually burned into my brain.
Mm.
And the name of the quote is called Always Things Doing at Joe Louis's Camp. And again, it's by Bob Murphy, and this article came out on June 22nd, so just a few days before the Primo Carnera fight. So I'm just going to read it in its entirety. And so it's about five paragraphs long, so anybody that needs to pour a drink or sit back, you know, relax or whatever, you know, take a moment to adjust your, you know, whatever you need to adjust, and sit back for a minute while you just listen to, you know, this of what it's what the scenery was like for somebody that was walking through this camp, just to, you know, to show how massive this was. So Pompton Lakes, New Jersey, June 22nd, situated at the heart of the Ramapo Mountains, hard by the peaceful waters of Pompton Lake. Joe Louis' bustling camp is in direct contrast to its placid surroundings. Something is doing every minute. Veteran fight followers say there has never been a fight camp conducted quite like this one. It is the same spot where Jack Sharkey, Primo Carnera, Tony Canzoneri, and others have prepared for important ring jousts, but somehow it remained for the hosts of Harlem to really add to the color. Pompton Lake is 35 miles from New York, Arriving at the camp, you will find your entrance barred by a heavy rope. But long before you reach the rope, you will find it lowered and a dusky gentleman bowing and scraping and showing pearly white teeth as he says, "Come in, sir. You are welcome, sir." Don't ask questions. Don't ask me why the rope is there. They neither ask you who you are or where you came from. Once on the grounds, your time is your own. There before you are wild groups laughing and talking. Everyone is taking everyone else's picture. At the particular time this correspondent arrived, it was 1:30 p.m. A well-groomed, youthful Negro approached me and said, "I'm Joe Lewis's secretary. Is there anything that we can do for you?" I explained, "First of all, I would like to talk with John Roxborough." In less time than it takes to tell, I was led to a frame house which housed Lewis, his sparring partners, managers, and whatnots. Two uniformed state policemen are at the door as you enter, but they don't bother to look you over. They are busy demonstrating the difference between Lewis's dazzling left and the slow, lazy punch Carnera uses. The two officers are practicing on some elderly Negro gentleman who keeps cautioning, "Careful, boss, not too close to the old chin, boss." Roxborough glad. Lewis's secretary produces Roxborough. John immediately makes it known that he is glad someone else has arrived from Detroit. "These other newspaper men are fine," he exclaims, "but it's awful nice to have our Detroit folks. Now you just come in and make yourselves at home, or yourself at home." Roxborough brings in Julian Black, his Chicago partner, who is half owner of Lewis. Black proves just as polite and equally as intelligent as Roxborough. Then comes another round of introductions. Roxborough's brother from Detroit was there. Black had brought along a few others from Chicago. All these were under the official roof. "Where's Joe?" I inquired. "Come here just a minute," said Roxborough, tiptoeing to the edge of the stairway. "Just listen to that noise." Your correspondent had heard something like it once when we visited our uncle who had a sawmill. Roxborough assured me, however, it was no sawmill, but only Joe Lewis snoring. Sleeps any minute. "I never in my life have seen anything like that boy," said Roxborough. He can fall off to sleep any minute he wants to, and he doesn't wake up until we go after him." Laughter interrupted the remainder of his conversation regarding Joe's sleeping prowess. In the next room, Joe's sisters, Voonies, Eulalia, and Susie, were tinkering with the billiard table. They had somebody behind the eight ball, judging from the laughter. This hardly had subsided until there came a fierce clawing at the back door. I turned to look into the face of a giant Great Dane dog. "Don't mind him," Roxborough said assuringly. "He's a dog that Betsy Krebs of Chicago loaned us to help out the looks of the camp. That dog and Joe took a liking to one another immediately. I'm wondering if we will be able to separate them." Roxborough decided it was high time he and Black should move over to press headquarters, located in a tavern something like 50 yards directly across from the current headquarters. All class of people. Inside were all class of people mingling in good fellowship. They were all assembled under one common banner, Joe Lewis. Newspaper men sat in one corner of the room discussing things. Black and Roxborough circled the place, assuring everyone, if they didn't see what they wanted, just ask for it. In a loft upstairs were telegraph wires. Newsmen were coming and going. Suddenly there was a commotion. Everyone rushed for the door. Joe Lewis had just roused from his slumber and was ready for his afternoon workout. Joe dressed fully to walk from his room to the gymnasium, which was only 75 yards away. He shook hands along the way, consented to several autographs, looked towards the assembled throng as they cheered, but through it all remained expressionless. Smiles at dog. The only time during the entire day, including his workout inside the ring, Lewis smiled was when the enormous Great Dane dog almost tore down a door to get to him. The dog had barked, whined, and pleaded. Finally, when denied entrance, the dog crashed to the screen. The spirit of destruction seemed to amuse the dark dynamiter from Detroit. He smiled the first and only smile I have ever seen him cross his deadpan. The dog was given an affectionate pet. The dog was given an affectionate pet. It's some training camp and no kidding. So it's gives you an idea.
You got a great picture of Joe sleeping
like,
in
but
bed.
This,
and
but
the
there's
dog
all this.
And,
there's
yeah,
like there's
the
press headquarters across the street. Yeah. He somebody goes, "Joe's awake," and they all flood out. Newspaper wires running through the ceilings. I've got another huge quote, but I want to save it.
It's a frenzy.
The next quote I have, I'm not going to read it today. We'll read it. We'll start off the next show with it. But the next quote is really shows the the craziness, because Joe's like actually sparring and doing this and that, and you can just see the crowd is like oohing and on. For, I mean, he paints an even bigger picture, but I want to save that for the next show, because we're actually gonna be leading into the Carnera fight.
Sure.
With the next episode.
So what does his training consist of?
So there, I mean, it's kind of like what he did before, you know, like where he's, you know, he's got his road work, he's got his, you know, eating, sleeping. It's I think they kept him on a very similar schedule as he did before.
And how many, like, is he sparring with people?
Yeah,
is
absolutely. He's got
who's he sparring with? Just Chappie.
I think I have some
Chappie's a little old to be sparring.
No, that's
with
what I'm
him,
saying. But. Like, we're gonna talk about that in the the quote will be the next quote. We'll kind of talk about it.
All right.
But I can give you a little bit of a teaser. The idea, since you asked, especially, you know, but he's got to bring in. They're trying to find these big bodies to represent.
Yeah, the tall.
And so what they're going to show is, I think it's going to be in the next quote. I think that is in the next one. Maybe it's in another quote. But one of the sort of sad things, and I actually have the quote for it. It might actually be in the training for the barefoot. But there's this quote where the reporter is actually kind of sad because he's watching Joe. I think it's for the bear fight that this quote we're actually gonna read it because the it's almost sickening what Joe does to these sparring partners.
Oh, real okay.
So
these guys are taking a walloping too.
They're not just taking a walloping. They're getting I mean it's bad.
Is it for the I wouldn't say the amusement of the press.
No, not at all.
This was
pure business, and that's what was sad was. That all they're doing is bringing in big-bodied guys that have. I mean, they're boxers, but these guys have no business being in the ring with Joe Lewis.
But they're just
big,
and he's hurting them.
And he's hurting them.
Oh.
And there's one that's where the quote I'm going to read when we get to the Bear section in a few episodes is so it's almost sad because because these guys are getting beat up so bad they can't even barely stand.
Wow.
And Joe was going through them so fast that Jack Blackburn's lecturing them I don't care, I want you up on your feet, get your butt in the ring, and give me another half a round,
right?
Because he can't even Joe, and Joe is not pulling any punches because he can't.
He was game.
He's got to get ready for this fight.
He was fight.
Yeah,
action, not
that's what's
he wasn't
sad.
Practicing.
Yeah, and I actually wrote about that in the screenplay.
And you gotta, I mean, I guess you gotta train at fight capacity or fight level.
Exactly, he can't take it easy.
Because they're
just punching bags for him.
Sure.
That's all they are.
Ow,
and that's what I mean. Like, he's got a punching bag, but a punching bag doesn't simulate an actual ring fight. And so that's why,
somebody acting and reacting
to it. Yeah, he needs a big body guy to work out his combinations and work out what he's going to do with a big body fighter. And so that's what's I actually wrote that into the screenplay. It's sort of almost like a tragic scene where there's in the screenplay, man, I don't soften it up. There's blood and gore all over the place.
Yeah.
And I got people being sick on the sidelines watching what's going on because that's what that quote conveys is that. Jack Blackburn, these guys don't there's actually guys in this scene where they find themselves in the ring and they're getting torn up so bad that they're trying to get out. And Jack Blackburn's no, you're not leaving. We need your big body in there.
Wow.
They can't even find enough guys to allow Joe Lewis to pummel them. So, because they're going through, they're chewing up, basically human freaking punching bags so fast. They don't even have the guys to supply, that's in the middle of a Great Depression and they're trying to get, paying good money to come in there and take some punches from Joe Lewis and they can't even find enough bodies.
Wow.
And that's what I mean. That's what's kind of, I think that quote's in the Bears section.
Sure.
But, it's just, but in essence, that's what they're doing is that Joe can't pull any punches and I think that for him, that's something that's never, I don't think discussed is, again, we talked about how Joe was this manufactured killer, actually Blackburn said was Joe ain't a natural born killer. He's a manufactured killer. He took credit and I manufactured
right, right.
a killer.
Because a couple of those early fights, he
almost kills. Oh, yeah. No, yeah.
And he went a little slower.
Went a little soft and almost cost him a couple fights,
yeah.
And especially when he was an amateur, there was one fight where it was for the championship of the amateur championship. And he kind of held back on a guy. And then the guy ended up having to go to decision or whatever. Like he won the fight, but he did, but it showed one of the issues that he would face and have to break, which was, and that's what Jack Blackburn was so emphatic over is you can't count on the referees. You have got to destroy people.
Right.
You cannot take it easy on anybody. And that includes your sparring partners. And I'm sure he probably had that conversation with them at some point saying,
this is going to hurt.
These guys, their job is to get you ready for this fight. And if you go half, if you go half speed against these guys and take it easy on them, then it'll lead you to be half speed and take it easy on Carnera when you get to the ring.
Hey,
and
fellas, so, this is going to sting a little, but yeah. We need you to help out Joe.
Yeah. So anyways, this, wow. So that's what I mean. Like, so that's what he's doing. He's doing his raw. I don't have the exact schedule for but I'm sure it was something similar to where he's waking up super early, doing his road work, gets in a big breakfast, takes a nap, like his regular routine that he had when he was when he was fighting, when he was kind of getting ready for all this. I'm sure they kept him in a fairly, because that routine was working for him. He's demolishing people. He's 19-0 plus, three other fights that didn't even count on his record. And so, he's doing his training. He's with a little extra excitement from autograph hounds and newspaper men and interviews and stuff. And so, all this is going on right now. Joe's getting ready for Primo Carnera, the biggest fight of his career.
Right.
But there's, unfortunately, we got to leave off with something sort of negative that happens at this point.
Okay? All right, what happens?
Because it's a critical component to the overall Joe Louis story.
All right.
So Primo Carnera's fight is June 25th.
Uh-huh.
And the article we just read was June 22nd. Right. So prior to both of these events, on June 13th, Max Baer is going to lose his championship to James Braddock.
Oh.
And so there's a movie called Cinderella Man.
Yeah.
Cinderella Man. It's a Ron Howard directed movie. It's a $100 million Hollywood movie. It stars Russell Crowe as James Braddock.
Colleen and I just watched it last week.
Oh, did you? Yeah. Okay. So that fight happens right now.
Oh, wow.
That fight happens now. And the reason why that is so significant.
Okay.
Is because the plan that they had outlined for Joe was that he was going to beat Primo Carnera, who was the guy who Max Baer had beaten for the championship belt, which was going to lead Joe to a shot at the heavyweight belt with Max Baer at the end of the year. So Joe would finish off this this incredible year as the heavyweight champion of the world.
But that shifts the whole timeline.
Now it shifts. It all changes because now Max Baer, he's still scheduled to face Baer. He's still got to fight Baer. But now Baer is no longer the heavyweight champion.
Right.
And what's even worse than that is that James Braddock is under club control by the Madison Square Garden. So there's no way the Madison Square Garden are going to give a fight to Mike Jacobs, who's coming for their, he's already taken their publicity from him with the Hearst newspapers. And Mike Jacobs is breathing down Jimmy Johnson's neck to run Madison Square Garden.
Mm-hmm.
He's becoming this major promoter, and the other thing, too, is that now the Garden, having James Braddock under contractual obligation, they control the belt.
Sure.
So they don't have to give Joe Louis a chance. They can just keep running heavyweight championship fights in the Madison Square Garden, and Joe Louis is just, as far as they're concerned, just an exhibition fighter.
Right.
He ain't had nothing to do with the Garden.
Right.
So now, because Max Baer, I think that Max Baer also had a contract with the Garden, but this was like one of the last fights, which actually kind of makes me wonder about whether or not I don't like to even say it out loud, but I think it's just crazy how all of a sudden Braddock has just got this belt and the Madison Square Garden controls, and I don't even want to suggest that's what happened because I'm a huge fan of Max Baer and I would not want to go down that road, but in either case, now the Garden is in control of the belt. And so, by the way, it was a decision. So it doesn't mean, I'm not even suggesting that Baer threw it. I'm saying there might have been something that went along the idea that the judges, leaned, heavily a point favorite towards Braddock or something.
Because
it wasn't even it's not like he got, Baer took a dive or something because he didn't get knocked out. He lost the belt on points.
Oh, it was a decision.
It was a decision. Oh, yeah. That's what I'm saying. Like, I'm not trying to lay this on Baer's
lap.
No.
If it was down to a decision.
That there's, there's.
I call shenanigans
big
time.
It could be. So. And that's what I mean. So this is the situation is that now Louis, and so now, I mean, this is another moment that I wrote in the screenplay was that, there's this moment that Joe's, they're like, because this isn't just as simple as, Max Baer's, after Max Baer, we're going to go face James Braddock for the belt. No, it's going to be like actually getting a chance at the heavyweight championship now. It's a whole nother story. This is a story. We could do it, 10 episodes on how Joe got his chance. And, yeah. I mean, he wouldn't. He's not going to end up winning.
How you get from here to there?
He's not even going to get his chance at the heavyweight championship till 1937.
Whoa.
He's not even going to get a chance at it. And so that's what I mean. Like, it's going to be two more years. That's the kind of politicking they had to go on behind the scenes.
You can just see that. Like, he's up in the ring, you know, training, and the throngs of people around him. And somebody comes up and says in his ears, Bear lost the belt.
Yeah. I mean, that's right. I have a scene. I have an actual scene I actually wrote a scene into the movie about them finding out and how dejected they were. There's nobody that knows that story about. I mean, there is. Maybe Joe Jr. knows something about it, you know, at that moment, you know. But I actually wrote into the screenplay that it was Joe that, you know, these people are all dejected and they're all in the house in Pompton Lakes and they're like, what are we going to, you know, what are we doing now? And then Joe is the one that's like, nothing changes. We're just going to keep winning and fighting and beating people, you know. And so that's how I wrote it into the movie, was that Joe himself is the guy that's, you know, actually breaks that. And like, and that's in the screenplay, Joe does very little talking. That's how I wrote the character. But when he does talk, it carries like gravitas, you know.
Right,
like when he does talk, it's always at a moment that's like, you know, like that's it's just a big moment. And then like they're not like surprised that Joe said something, but they're just but whenever he does talk, like, you know, it just carries, you know, he's extra weight because he is so quiet.
Yeah.
And so it's you know, now he's got, you know, there's no chance for him in essence to win the heavyweight championship in 1935, even though he emerges as the premier fighter.
Sure.
You see?
Wow.
So that's what I mean. So this so that is the, you know, sort of a downside to this, you know, particular story component. But
crazy business. All right, so we'll be back with more, right? Episode 46
46 is on deck.
We're going to see how that fight turns out. How's he handle the big guy? And we'll get to all of that. Like, subscribe, collect, leave a comment wherever your fine podcasts are sold. We appreciate you being along with us. And till next time, put them up.